Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Hello, my friends. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. Our guest for today will be noted San Francisco attorney, Mr. Tony Serra, and I'm going to bring you the speech I gave to the Harris County Commissioners and to Judge Eccles and their response. But first up, Mr. Tony Serra.
My name's Tony Serra, and I'm a criminal trial lawyer, and I have been such for 42 years with an office in San Francisco. And over the years, I've probably developed a good rep. I've tried cases up to about 45 different jurisdictions, 28 different states. I've won four death penalty cases. And by win, it's always a team effort, but I would be lead counsel. I've done drug cases from their inception, really, in the mid-60s. I was part of the Haight-Ashbury movement. I participated in all of the dimensions, let's just say, of the Haight-Ashbury movement. So I'm kind of considered an old hippie, and with a you know, good trial record. And I've represented in the drug field all of the various, how would I call it, the drug movements. And what I'm talking about is in the earliest stages, you know, it was heroin, and after that there was lots of marijuana and hashish and the psychedelics. San Francisco touched, you know, the LSD and the mushroom trade and the psilocybin trade and the mescaline trade, and then thereafter there was the cocaine blitz, and thereafter there was the methamphetamine blitz, and thereafter there is presently the great battle over medical marijuana in California. So I've been participatory on all levels, you know, with respect to those, what I'll call, I don't know, social phenomena. I've been fighting the narcs and fighting the DEA and fighting the unjust laws really since the hippie days of the 60s. So, I don't know, that's basically my background.
Well, Mr. Serra, let me focus, if we can, on the situation currently developing in San Diego. I think they busted 13...
clubs
there. Your thoughts on that, sir?
Well, this is my thoughts. One of the greatest disgraces, you know, from the point of view of general public has just occurred prior to this marijuana bust, and that is Republican Congressman Cunningham's pleading of guilty to extreme corruption and bribery, and all of the contracts that he gave based on bribery. It is disgusting. You know, another culture would have taken him out and hung him. And what is the government response to this infamy? You know, let's call it the executive branch. They raid 13 pot clubs. They don't go after, I guess they're you know, giving some lip service of going after the lobbyists and the contractors, you know, that all benefited from this corruption and, you know, for going after the various strata that surrounded and aided and embedded. No. What they do to divert, and, you know, I'm political, and so I'm always cynical. The timing here is suggestive of a nexus. They raid 13 pot clubs. Well, God damn them, you know. So, you know, my disdain for the executive when they overreach and when they seek ultimately, you know, to repress the people's will and the free flow of democratic process, I am always outraged. So what's my attitude toward it? It is, you know, from my perspective, with ulterior motive. Secondly, it's completely overkill. They could have, as they do on occasion and have done in the past, they can always go by injunction. If they have a bona fide, you know, concern, they can go by injunction, civil injunction. So when they raid, like they raided three Asian clubs here in San Francisco, there are ulterior motives. Sometimes it's racistic and sometimes it's political. So, you know, I think it's a disgrace. I think, however, it's a manifestation of this Bush administration, more and more resources, you know, toward phony, you know, war on drugs and enlarging, let's call it, the police state, enlarging the informant doctrine, and ultimately squeezing the life out of the Fourth and First Amendments. So, you see, I just see it as part of a pattern, and San Diego is known to be conservative, and therefore they strike hard there on medical marijuana. Up here in San Francisco, we're known to be just the opposite. On the other hand, out of approximately 41 clubs, they raided three in the recent past, and as I said, all Asian, and I think they had ulterior motive there. So, you know, I'm not surprised, because Bush administration is, you know, trying to gather as much power and resources as it can and strengthen the executive at every move. So I'm not surprised, but I remain outraged.
Well, sir, many within Reform talk about the fact that for alcohol, they had to have a constitutional amendment, then they had another one to reverse it, and yet for drugs, there has never been, in their opinion, a constitutional change to these laws.
No, you're absolutely right. We've been brainwashed now for decades with respect generically to drugs and more recently, but back then also with regard to marijuana. So we have really the culturally, let's say, exposed and the culturally ignorant, and the ignorant dominate with regard to marijuana. You know, otherwise the medical marijuana issue would be more widespread. It is increasing state by state and by European country after the next, but it's being so strongly resisted, and it's resisted by the kind of the far right coalitions that are ignorant of at least the medical component of marijuana. You see, there is a vulnerability in law, and lawyers, I believe, all over the country, certainly in California, are singling out that issue for reattack, and that's in the marijuana field, the scheduling issue. The feds will not concede, and I'm talking about the executive, will not concede that there is any medicinal value to marijuana. As a consequence, it's Schedule One, which is the most serious of all drugs. It's in the same category, for instance, as methamphetamine. And even heroin, having medical, usages through morphine, is not Schedule One, it's Schedule Two. So it's outrageous that marijuana that has been used for at least three centuries in every advanced culture during that time period as a medicine, and, First Amendment issues here too, as a sacrament in many occasions. It is outrageous that the government refuses, to put the truth before the political issue, that they, in essence, put their head in the sand. So there's motions regarding the classification. So you got to look for a chink in the armor. And that's the chink in the armor, because the rest of the educated world has acknowledged, and the enlightened in the United States, and this is, Dr. Lawyer and Indian Chief, they have medical proponent of marijuana is strong and practical and effective. But the government refuses. So that is the new arena for attack, and that is happening in both North and South in California. It's not going to the electorate. It is not passing, an amendment to the Constitution. It is not overwhelming the legislature. Those methods will not prevail because we're still in a mist of ignorance for the most part with regard to the effect of all drugs, but especially marijuana. But here, if we could start, this is practical and it's within our reach. It's within the reach of the judicial process. If we could just change the scheduling for marijuana and expose their willful ignorance, I think that would be a step in a good direction.
Mr. Serra, you mentioned sacramental use. I understand that one of your clients, Mr. Eddie Lepp, wants to challenge the government on that factor. Your thoughts there, sir?
Yeah, no, it's just fortunate that a number of good, factors converged. Firstly, he is a bona fide Rastafarian. Secondly, there is law that supports the Rastafarians' use of marijuana as a sacrament. So there's a foundation of law, and he happens, to be the real thing. Thirdly, and this is probably the most critical, significant element, he is willing to risk 20 years. He's facing a minimum mandatory 20 years in the top of life because he had Rasta, and my word would be church, but I don't know exactly, what was called, but he was a minister for the Rasta. He had a center, it was a church, and all the members were participating in quite a large grow. They did it open and notoriously. They sent letters to the governor. They sent letters to law enforcement. We are growing under the First Amendment to religious use. We, our Rastas, words to that effect. So, yes, there's going to be a trial, and, we're hoping that the judge will give an instruction with regard to Rasta's use. It is in the book, so, we're optimistic. He is the real thing, and therefore we could establish a de facto precedent if we could get an acquittal. And of course, if we don't, this is why he's so beautiful and he's so real, he's going to do significant time. He'll be in for the rest of his life. But he's a man of principle, and he stands behind his vision, and he's a bona fide Rasta. So, it's completely exciting. And yes, it's in San Francisco federal court. It's just in the motion stage. It'll be a while before it actually goes to trial. We don't have a trial date yet.
Oft times, people get caught with small amounts of drugs. They are offered the chance to reduce or eliminate their sentence if they will simply turn in their associates. Your thoughts on the snitches in this country?
Yeah, well, we call it three for free out here. On the small user, if you'll then turn in three co-users or co-providers, you go free. Three for free, and the federal system is much larger. I mean, they're not interested in users, but their drug cases, even if predicated on wiretap or infiltrated with informants, still coerces co-defendants or co-arrestees into becoming cooperating witnesses. Phenomenon I don't think that any judicial system has ever countenanced previously. You see, when you're in a quest for truth, that can be the only premise upon which justice is arrived, to rely on the word of people who've been coerced, that you're facing 20 years, tell us what we want to hear, and we're going to give you 5 years. They're psychologically tortured in furnishing the government what the government wants to hear. and not necessarily the truth. And if you want my life, these people who are highly pressured, psychologically tortured by grand jury or by draconian sentences, who become, you know, informants and cooperating defendants, that you're lucky, you know, if 50% are telling the truth, because they will lie to save their own skin. And it's a huge phenomenon now. We have more words for informants in our legalese than any other culture ever has. And we've got confidential, reliable informants. We've got confidential informants. We have sources of information. We have material informants. We have participatory informants. We have informants, you know, before the case, after the case, during the case. Informants who give information that leads to search warrants. Informants who give information that lead to wiretap. We have so much nomenclature for informants, and it is such a mushroom in the field of law that it casts a shadow over the integrity of the entire judicial system. So, you know, I've been fighting perjurious informants all of my career. They had them in the Haight-Ashbury. They still have them. The government out there every day of the week is coercing someone psychologically into becoming an informant or a cooperating witness. It is a disease. It hits in high places. You will see people in government and or in these corporate scandals, oh, they're rolling on each other as fast as they can. And every time they testify, you know, for leniency. And so it's much like the government is paying off. That is, if I went out and I bought a witness, if I said, Mr. Witness, I need someone, you know, I'll pay you $10,000 if you saw this. Did you see that? Oh, yeah, I saw that. Well, here's your $10,000. Let's go in and testify. What would happen? Oh, we'd all be, I'd be disbarred. I'd be prosecuted. The witness be prosecuted. What does the government do? The only thing more precious than money for many is freedom. Years off. We'll give you 15 years off. Did you see X do that? Oh, yes, I saw X do it, says the person. You know, he's facing draconian time. He won't see his family again. His children will be old. They know how to psychologically, you know, coerce you. And that kind, so we're a judicial system that relies at the base of it, when it comes to drug cases, for the most part, and more in the federal than in the state system, we rely on tainted evidence. Psychologically tortured people who are given freedom, and which is more valuable than money, and it's all legal. If they do it, it's legal. And it is a disgrace. It's a blemish on our system of justice. It's a blemish on the whole Constitution. It is something we shouldn't countenance. We should not have an informant. We shouldn't have a spy system. It is George Orwell's, you know, prophecy. Ultimately, you know, it becomes like Hitler's youth corps. They used to inform on their parents. It's this Judas syndrome. It's been, you know, the kind of repulsed by all cultures, and American judicial process embraces it. So, you know, I have nothing but disdain for it.
You are listening to Cultural Baggage on the Drug Truth Network. Our guest for this edition, noted San Francisco attorney, Mr. Tony Serra. I ask Mr. Serra to draw a comparison, as I often do, between the war on terror and the war on drugs.
The modus operandi, let's just say, of infiltrating is in multiple levels, is obviously being used, you know, in other areas. But let me give examples, at least in the drug areas. You know, we had a time where our government, in connection, let's say, with foreign governments, and still going on, you know, pays large sums or advances large resources to kind of stamp out, let's call it marijuana in Mexico, or could be the coca leaves down in South America, etc. And like that, so that's one level. It's political and it's resources and it's, you know, money, like let's say to the establishment down there. And then the next level is a spy system. We investigate in those countries by infiltrating groups directly, sometimes with DEA agents, always with kind of agents that are informant types for the DEA. They work with the narcotic units of other countries. They have a system that's predicated on informants, spies, and people who are deep cover, just like the movies say they do. Beyond that, they're not fettered, let's say, by constraints. And I have at least had one case where the DEA agents are in one room and a person's being tortured in the next room. You know, they're just there waiting for the for the benefit of the torture, and you know, that's another method. And so it probably, you know, I'm trying to support your premise. Probably that methodology has been used, multidimensional, you know, probes, and to promote some political advantage. It's probably been used for decades and decades, but let's just say that became very prominent, and it was backed, you know, by lots of resources in the so-called war against drugs. And then I agree with you, they've taken it to the next step in terms of war on so-called terrorists. But it, and the next step is even for, you know, it's overt torture, it's covert prisons, you know, without charges and without rights. It's the engaging, you know, of foreign troops to resources, you know, provided to complete a political agenda, like a disease that has magnified with time. That is the American method of intrusion into a foreign culture to either abate or promote its own political advantage. And understand this, the world, the civilized world, I'm talking, you know, not just the third world, I'm talking Europe, they hate us for it. We, you know, are the new empire builders, we are the new whatever invaders, the oil seekers, we, you know, torture, we through Machiavellian means, might makes right prevail, you know, over their culture. It's as sinister, you know, as the English colonialism period, and Bush is, from my, you know, point of view, the figurehead of the movement. Let's see what happens next. You know, next is the Patriot Act, and after that, the concept of domestic terrorism is on the rise. You get a few young kids, you know, hugging a tree, and they become domestic terrorists up in Northern California. I'm talking about the Redwoods. So we're in a dangerous state. Totalitarian, you know, KGBism is alive and well in the United States. The so-called thin blue line has become a thick blue wall that suffocates our civil rights and freedoms. And for the most part, we're apathetic and fear-stricken, and you know, without any capacity or vision to see it or to block it. Half the people in the United States, you say, will you give up the First Amendment? Will you give up the Fourth Amendment? We'll protect you. Oh, it's very dangerous out there. It's chaotic out there. You know, your life and liberty and savings are in jeopardy. But give us the Fourth Amendment. Give us the First Amendment. Give us the Fifth Amendment, and you will be secure. You'll have your car, and you'll have your television, you know, you'll have your little physical comforts, and we will protect you, says Big Brother. And if you put that out to vote right now, more than 50% of the Americans would sign off. They'd sign off the Constitution because they're in a state of fear and trembling that has mostly been propagated by United States and in, you know, in my mind, a very deceptive method, just like they're buying articles over in Baghdad. They've been doing that for years one way or the other.
Mr. Sarah, we just have a minute left. Some closing thoughts. What might those who are disturbed by the current situation, what might they do? What would you recommend?
here's what I recommend. You manifest your rage and you protest and do it all legally. We in San Francisco, after they busted those 13 medical marijuana clubs in San Diego, went to the federal building and we raised our semantic fist and we yelled and screamed and protested. That's, you know, that's one direct method. The media picks it up. If there's meaning and reason to your protest, it does convince the unconvinced. You don't want to preach to the choir. You know, you want to preach to the persons who are out there who still are confused by government propaganda. So rage, rage at the dying of the light, the so-called Dylan Thomas refrain, is what should be done.
This week, I went before Judge Eccles and the Harris County Commissioners to talk about the beginnings of this 92nd year of drug war and how it impacts our community. I misspoke during my speech. I named Mayor Brown, who was our former mayor and a former drug czar as well. I did make a correction that our current mayor is Mayor White. Brown or White certainly makes a big difference when you're held in the Harris County Jail.
My name is Dean Becker. I'm a reporter for the Drug Truth Network. We broadcast on 49 stations in the U.S. and Canada, including Houston's KPFT 90.1 FM. Last week, I talked to Mayor Brown and the City Council. They laughed and joked at a computer screen while I told them their drug war policy sends black Houstonians to prison at a rate substantially higher than did South Africa under apartheid. Sir?
He didn't meet Mayor Brown last week to talk to him. Mayor White.
Thank you. Their crime lab remains an international scandal, and yet political rope-a-dope followed by silence was their only response. Today, I come to you, Judge Eccles, and commissioners, to make note that we now have entered our 92nd year of drug war, and Houston, Harris County, leads the world in the incarceration of our own people. Primarily for drugs, empty bags, empty pipes, small amounts of drugs, we lead the world. Texas wardens tell me that perhaps 85% of the people in our prisons are there for drugs or because of a lifestyle that revolves around drugs and the black market in drugs. Texas prisons are nearing overflow once again, and your jail, the Harris County Jail, seems to be making a draconian return to the dark ages. Depending on the day of the week, at least 1,000, if not 2,000 people are sleeping on the floor. Some have lumpy, dirty, worn-out mattresses, and many hundreds are sleeping on the cold concrete floors. Prisoners still get their drinking water from the back of the toilet. Disease and infections are rife, and our ability to pay attention to prisoners' medical needs is diminishing rapidly. Last week, Major Brownfield of the Sheriff's Department, who oversees the jail on your behalf, decided that nobody will be allowed to tour the jail facility from here on, claiming the need of increased security. He insists that not even the press will be allowed inside. I spoke with Mr. Terry Julian, director of Texas Commission on Jail Standards, and he told me that even he cannot force the Sheriff's Department to open the jail for an inspection. Will you call Major Brownfield, please, and instruct him to allow me to tour the jail facilities, or will my listeners once again hear silence from those we have elected?
Nothing but silence. And also, it's been reported by Capitol Hill Blue newspaper that last month, during a meeting with Republican supporters, President Bush was heard to say, "Don't throw the Constitution in my face. It's just a goddamn piece of paper." Once again, I remind you, because of Prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful. To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Jap dancing on the edge of an abyss.